Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 22nd of September, 2013. Nav Briefing 87, The Rule of the Kalikas. This briefing is a direct follow-up on the same day to the previous briefing entitled The Record of the Three Attentions. I recorded that briefing in the early pre-dawn hours of the morning, and it's now about 10 o'clock here on a bright and beautiful autumn day in Spain. I'm proceeding in this second briefing with some references to Carlos Castaneda and the not just The Eagle's Gift, which is the one book I happen to have at hand, but the entire extent of Castaneda's legacy, which was immense and spanned a period of three decades. To what extent it continues to this day, I can't really say. Who is practicing the extension and extrapolation of the Neo-Toltec sorcery of Don Juan and his party is anybody's guess. There are a number of Castaneda forums on the internet, of course. They are still active. The most well-known is called Sustained Reaction, and it has literally tens of thousands of posts in a wide range of categories discussing many aspects of Castaneda's work. But the existence of a forum in virtual reality on the internet, even if it is an impressive forum with a large membership and continually a forum that is continually generating and registering new content, is still just a forum on the internet. It doesn't necessarily attest to practices that may be undertaken based upon the teachings of Carlos Castaneda. Okay, so what about other activities, other aspects that could be considered as the follow-up and continuation of Castanedan sorcery, if you want to call it that? Well, I don't know about that either. I'm terribly ignorant of these activities. Of course, I'm out of the loop in a great many ways as far as things happening on this planet is concerned. And this includes the knowledge of anyone who might designate themselves as the heirs to the Castaneda legacy, or practitioners of Neo-Toltec sorcery, a continuation of the lineage of Don Juan. Is anyone hearing these words define themselves to be in the continuation of the lineage of Don Juan and Carlos Castaneda? Well, give me a buzz and let me know. And I'd like to know what you're doing and what's the point. Of course, Toltec sorcery and the general meme of the Toltecs and Maya culture and Maya psychotronics and that whole mystique is alive and well, and certainly has a following here and there around the world. There are groups. There are teachers, I can't name any of their names, but I know there are a number of well-known and prominent teachers who purport to be presenting workshops and seminars on Toltec shamanism, which is slanted in one way or another toward Castaneda's legacy. But again, what's the point? What is the objective or aim or goal of that kind of shamanism? Now, in planetary tantra, the telos, the objective or goal, is very clear: interactive magic with the earth. I think it's remarkable that the seventh book, which would be The Fire from Within, contains a number of indications pointing to this notion, interactive magic with the earth. As a matter of fact, I can't locate exactly where it would be, but somewhere in that volume, The Fire from Within, or maybe in a later one, there is a scene where Don Hinero is levitating, and he specifically says that all of the magic they do comes from the earth, that they're in love with the earth, in love with the power of the earth, and everything they do comes out of that love and adoration. And that paradigm of sorcery is, of course, the exact paradigm of planetary tantra. So you could say that the ground formula of planetary tantra, if you will, was already stated in some passages in Castaneda's books. The difference is that as planetary tantra goes forward today, the definition of Gayan tantra and Gayan shamanism is rigorous and precise, and the goals and practices, the practices and methods are shared by people who engage in planetary tantra are all directed toward very particular and singular goals. And I don't know if those who practice Neo-Toltec sorcery or anything along those lines would share the same goals. Also, I'd like to point out that no one in planetary tantra is obliged to accept the rule of the Nahual or the description of the eagle as presented in the Eagle's Gift. The goal of Gayan shamanism is, of course, freedom. But that is not an end in itself. Once you have freedom, then what do you do with it? You see? So the goal of Gayan shamanism coincides with that of Castaneda's party, but also perhaps at a certain point departs and goes further toward a definition of the purpose of magic, the definition of what I call the sorcery of love and intention. Ah, that word, love, yes. Now here's another factor. Been reflecting on this a lot lately. You know, what is the role of personal love in Castaneda's sorcery? Do the members of the Warriors Party feel great personal love for each other? Well, at certain times it certainly appears that they do. They quarrel a lot and they have their differences. They're all united in their love for freedom. But as warriors, they don't indulge in the personal. So where is the factor of personal love? Or where was the factor of personal love in Carlos Castaneda's own life? You know, being a kalika, I define people ultimately by their addictions. So I define myself as a sex and romance addict. In that respect, I have certain similarities with Castaneda. You can speak of the Casanova complex or the Don Juan complex. You know, it's been pointed out that Don Juan, which is the rather banal name that Castaneda gave to the main character in his stories, is known in another context, in a European context, as a womanizer, a Casanova. So that kind of motif lingers like smoke around the figure of the Nahual Don Juan and around the figure of Castaneda himself. And I would say that Castaneda was most definitely a Casanova, so you can say Carlos Castanova if you want to. He was a Casanova Castaneda. And he was a womanizer from all accounts of his personal life, if you believe them. And I'm not sure I believe any account of Castaneda's personal life, including the one that comes from Amy Wallace in the book The Sorcerer's Apprentice. But to get back to this topic of the Casanova complex, sure, I could say that I have something of a complex like that because my addiction is a sex and romance addiction. But I don't think that Castaneda had a sex and romance addiction as such. I think that he may have had a sex and love addiction, which is not the same thing. Now, sex and love addiction is really problematical as far as love is concerned. You see, I don't have a love addiction. And because I have a sex and romance addiction, the factor of love is free. The factor of love in my history and in my predilection as a warrior and as a man is not implicated in my addiction. So love comes to me. I don't have a problem with love. I have loved a good number of women in my life, deeply, and also a few men. And I have been loved and am loved deeply by women and men. There's no problem with love. But if you have a sex and love addiction, by contrast to a sex and romance addiction, then there's a problem with love. Again, I must qualify what I'm going to say now. I must put out a disclaimer. I am not certain about any of the information that I have ever received or read or heard about Carlos Castaneda's personal life. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that you go upon the portrait of his behavior presented in Amy Wallace's book. This is clearly the profile of a womanizer. And I would say as well, it is indicative of a man in search of love, a man who wants to love and wants to be loved, such that the power of his addiction drives him to that, toward that experience. But whether or not his addiction delivered the experience, I can't say, and I'm inclined to think that it didn't. I'm not saying that Carlos Castaneda didn't love certain people in his circle of friends and allies and associates. I'm sure he did, and I'm sure that there were many people that loved him as well, or some. I just don't think that he found the love that he was really looking for, craving for, consistent with his addiction. You know, I can assure you that addiction is a very precise animal. And addiction is like an animal that has a very specific prey and only preys on its selected prey. So addiction is a predator-like force of desire. And the predator has a selected prey. So if you have a sex and romance addiction, then the addiction can only be satisfied precisely by that. Sex and romance in a particular mix and in the consummate, absolutely consummate expression of that mix. It's the only thing that can satisfy that addiction, as it were, the ultimate prey or food of the addiction, that which it seeks. And I would venture to say that if Castaneda was a sex and love addict, that he did not find the absolute consummation of that love. One thing that would have stood in the way, of course, was his celebrity and his cult figure status. He was a legend in his own time. And it seems obvious, if you take the report of Amy Wallace as true, that Castaneda used his cult status and the mystique generated around him to attract women and to feed the sexual hunger, which was one component of his sex and love addiction. But did it feed the hunger for love? I don't think so. So he had plenty of specimens to feed to his addiction, women who came to him and women upon whom he preyed sexually. He was, in certain respects, a sexual predator. I don't think that he was necessarily an evil one. I don't know. It could be said, and I'll say it myself, as a matter of fact, that I could be considered to be a kind of sexual predator. But that is not necessarily, in the range and scope of human matters, a bad thing. Doesn't mean that I'm a pedophile, I don't prey on children, or I don't rape women, I'm not a rapist. But the predatory aspect of the sexual drive that I'm describing simply refers to the intensity of sexual craving. And so if you have an intense sex drive, then you crave the women who will satisfy that drive, or the men if you're a woman. So I think that Castaneda craved both sex and love, and he would appear that he got a fair amount of sex, but I don't think he got the love, and he didn't get that consummate mix, which is what the addiction requires in order to be satisfied. Although, truth be told, such an addiction can never be satisfied. That is the nature of the addiction. It can be satisfied to the level that you can stand it, that you can stand the beauty and intensity you attain, but never to the point where you give up the addiction, because it's so good that you never want to give it up. So the question of love could be discussed a lot here. What is the role of love in Castaneda's sorcery, and what is the role of love in Gayaneko sorcery or planetary tantra? Well, the role of love in planetary tantra is upfront and primary, as you know. The second instruction of planetary tantra is love and the supernatural operate on the same frequencies. So love is incorporated in the instructive syntax of planetary tantra, whereas desire is incorporated in the instructive syntax of Kala Tantra. Now, the question of love is a daunting one and an important question in the context of this talk, this briefing, and the previous one. Looking at what Castaneda achieved, and asking, well, where is it going today? At the same time, we're looking at planetary tantra and comparing it with what Castaneda achieved. Now, I think that some of you may have seen the section on metahistory called The Gnostic Castaneda. I'm looking it up right now because I want to make sure that I know where you can find it. So you go to MetaHistory, the home page, and there on the left, in the left-hand column, you see the head of Kali underneath Site Guide. Click on Site Guide, and you come to a page where you have a menu tree, again in the left column, Topics. Go down to the topic of Gnostique and click, and then you'll come to a set of writings, starting with Gnostic Sabotage in the Book of Revelation, which are actually talks. Then there's Metacritique, scroll down, the Archon Files, scroll more, Tar Baby Jesus, Telestics, and after Telestics, you come to the Gnostic Castaneda. And I don't know if you're familiar with these writings. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pieces in this section. And in The Sham and the Slither, I talk about, or I offer some kind of loose assessment of Castaneda's shamanism. And I refer in The Sex and the Sorcerer and The Sorcerer's Bluff to the question of sexuality and love in Castaneda. So I've written there Carlos Casanova 1 and Carlos Casanova 2. Also, for those of you who may not have seen this yet or may have forgotten, one of the early pieces that I put on Metahistory, it's dated to June 2005, gives a list of about a dozen parallels between the writings of Carlos Castaneda and Gnostic teachings. And that is a remarkable set of correspondences, to say the least. I'm still astonished today when I read this and how many common points there were between Gnosticism and the Toltec-derived neo-shamanism of Carlos Castaneda. So I might want to go back and review that. I mentioned there the Toltec figure of the eagle, and the organization of the sorcerer's party into 8 pairs of male and female sorcerers, comparable to the organization of mystery cells into 16 members, 8 of each sex, and on and on and on. And perhaps most remarkable of all, the correlation of the bizarre item of the assemblage point and the luminous egg to Gnostic teachings as recorded by G.R.S. Mead in his book, The Subtle Body in Western Tradition, where he actually refers to the assemblage point. The Gnostic teacher said that the luminous oval is connected or locked into the physical body at a point in the back high up on the right shoulder blade, which is exactly what Castaneda says about the luminous egg. So, you might want to go back and review that material, since the subject of Castaneda is in the air these days. I coined the term the sorcery of love and intention at a dinner conversation here in Spain in July of 2008. The sorcery of love and intention. I didn't even know what it meant at the time that I said it, but I felt that it was a consummate syntax for what was to come. And I stand by that. Love, personal and transpersonal, is a key component in planetary tantra and the Gaian tantric way. And as far as freedom goes, you may remember freedom being the primary goal, stated goal of Castaneda's sorcerer party. As far as freedom goes, you may recall I said, don't talk to me about love unless you talk to me about freedom at the same time. Or don't talk to me about freedom unless you talk to me about love. So there are two things that are inseparable and cannot be discussed or considered independent of each other. So I would say that the rule of the Nahual presented in the Eagle's Gift is flawed because it does not include or consider the factor of love. It puts the emphasis entirely on the factor of freedom. And, of course, you can't, not of course, but I would add that you can't fudge that syntax by saying, but wait, those in the sorcerer's party who wish to follow the rule of the Nahual and slip past the eagle do so because of their love for freedom. I'm not talking about love for freedom. I'm talking about the love that you express when you are free. And as far as I can see, and of course my perception is limited and fallible, but as far as I can see, that expression of love is not to be found in the legacy of shamanism deriving from Carlos Castaneda. And I would strongly suspect that he did not find the love that he craved, although he certainly found a lot of sexual satisfaction and had an endless succession of sexual adventures through the women who were pulled into his cultic mystique. Between myself and Castaneda, that's pretty much where the parallel ends. I don't have any desire to generate a cultic mystique, and I don't have any intention to use whatever attraction might reside in the figure of the Nahual for the purpose of luring women. I have other means of doing that, which serve me quite well, thank you. So, I really find these reflections on Castaneda so relevant to the timing of the GNE right now. I don't know, are you feeling the same thing? Are you having the same intuition? I'd like to point out something regarding timing. You know, I haven't spoken so much about the perigee hits as I have about the apogee hits. In fact, the last account I gave, you will recall, I was meticulously reporting on the perigee hits in the scales, which was a very complicated pattern, jumping back and forth, then down into the scorpion. But the perigee hits have already advanced through the scorpion, through the archer, and into the goatfish. Remember, I pointed out that on September 15th, not too long ago, there occurred the first lunar perigee in or near the head of the goatfish. That would be in 1 degree of the sign Aquarius. So, the lunar perigee has advanced tremendously from where it was when we were last taking close notice of its movements, right? In the interval, it had to pass through the body of the scorpion, and it had to make a number of hits in the archer, which it did, beginning in the first month of 2013. So let me just run down for you what the perigee hits in the archer have been. January 10th, 2013, in 1 degree of Capricorn, which is at the tip of the archer's arrow. February 7th, in 10 Capricorn, which is at the hand pulling the string of the bow, the hand holding the string of the bow, which also marks the vein of the arrow. Then, again, on June 23rd, again in 2 degrees of Capricorn, close to the tip of the arrow, and on July 21st, in 15 Capricorn, sort of in the elbow of the archer. And so it goes. On August 19th, there was a hit in Capricorn, but that was in the empty space between the archer and the goatfish. And there remains two more hits in the archer. On December 4th this year, upcoming, again, 1 or 2 degrees Capricorn. That will be the third hit at the tip of the arrow of the archer, December 4th this year. And finally, in January 1st of 2014, 14 degrees of Capricorn, which again is in the area of the thrust of the arm that is pulling back, both pulling back the string of the bow, therefore creating the tension to shoot the arrow, and steadying the sight of the archer. So those in totality are all the perigee hits in the constellation of the archer. Now you might ask, well, what does that have to do with Carlos Castaneda and Neo-Toltec sorcery? Well, it's quite simple. If you go to the birthday of Carlos Castaneda, if you accept that given date of December 25th, 1925, you find that the sun is in the archer, near the forward hand that holds the bow. And although there are not a lot of other planets in the archer, there are planets in the region of the empty space associated with the archer. For instance, the south node of the moon is conjunct Jupiter in the empty space before the head of the goatfish. And also, the primary emphasis of the sun, which indicates the myth you live, tells us that the myth Castaneda lived was the myth of the archer. And since we know that the myth he lived was the myth of Neo-Toltec sorcery, then we can infer that the archer represents, on biological evidence, the phenomenon of Neo-Toltec sorcery. That is a precursor form of Gayan Tantra and Gayan shamanism that would come under the tutelage and guidance of Kuru Kula, who is frequently shown with a bow and arrow, right? Now, bear in mind that Kuru Kula is a powerful witch who deals with matters of sorcery, including casting all kinds of spells, but she is also a love goddess. So then again, I would say that the star-based parameters for Castaneda fit. I would accept that birth date, although others have been proposed, I would accept that birth date as correct, because the star-based parameters that I see when I look at the ephemeris fit the life and activities and intentions of Carlos Castaneda in a remarkable way. It's interesting that I mentioned Rajneesh not too long ago, and I consider Rajneesh to be one of the very rare precursors of Kala Tantra. And I consider Castaneda to be a rare precursor of Planetary Tantra. And both of them are strongly indicated by the constellation of the Archer, correlated to Kuru Kula. In fact, Rajneesh has even a stronger indication in the natal pattern due to planets located in the archer. So what does this all mean? Well, it suggests to me that from the very beginning of 2013, when that first hit occurred near the arrowhead of the archer, the extended point of the arrow, which actually points to the galactic center, from the moment of that first perigee hit, the Kalika War Party has been coming into definition more and more clearly. And as it does so, whatever might have happened in the past decades of the first generation of the nine generations of Kali, beginning in 1945. Whatever may have happened from 1945 until now that represents a precursor or preparation for Planetary Tantra would have come forth and reemerged and been redefined and re-identified in the pattern of these hits. So even though I haven't taken you through that pattern in real time at the moment that they happened, I'm telling you now, retrospectively, that that is what happened during these perigee hits in the Archer. There was a series of developments from the beginning of this year, leading up to what I'm saying right now, leading up to NAV briefing 86 and 87, with Castaneda as the primary topic, and Castaneda's legacy as a lead-in to Planetary Tantra. It is impossible not to see, not to recognize four or five outstanding themes from Castaneda that now reappear in the third year of the GNE. What are these themes? One, the double. Two, dreaming together. Three, the paradigm of the three attentions. Four, the configuration of the warrior's party. And a few others as well. So going forward now, in Planetary Tantra, I find that there's an opportunity to pick up and reiterate these elements from Castaneda, and to carry them forward and to make them over and revise them and extrapolate them in any way we like. For instance, were we to compile this inventory of the first, second, and third attention by noting every passage in the books in which he said something on those topics, we would have a record of the three attentions. That would be instructive. It would be highly entertaining. But no one is required or obliged to abide by what Castaneda said, because we ourselves are currently actively experimenting with those three attentions. And what we discover now is more valuable than a mere record from the past. The record that we ourselves are generating now is more important and more valuable than a record from the past. Nevertheless, whatever value you may draw from Castaneda's teaching regarding those three attentions can be, of course, helpful and instructive and not to be disregarded. As a matter of fact, I consider that material to be worthy of deep interest and respect. Sorcerers talk tradecraft. They talk shop talk. They trade secrets and savvy. And there's plenty of shamanic savvy in those books by Carlos Castaneda. What I find particularly pertinent at the moment is that aspect of the rule of the Nahual, which concerns setting up a complicated arrangement of men and women participants in the sorcerer's party. You know, as I mentioned in a previous briefing, Castaneda really pulls a number there in that chapter of the Eagle's Gift. At the very moment that he brings out the rule of the Nahual, which could stand alone as an abstract principle or guideline for sorcery, he hits you with this picture. It's a very elaborate and complicated picture of the male and female warriors in the party of eight and the party of 16. And for some mysterious reason, the rule of the Nahual and the will of the eagle itself requires that the sorcerer's party, or the party of the Nahual, if you will, be comprised of these particular type of individuals in this particular relationship to each other. And you know, the most outstanding, or one of the outstanding features of that, is the female warriors. So, again, I'm quoting from the Eagle's Gift. The Eagle created the first Nahual man and Nahual woman as seers and immediately put them in the world to see. He provided them with four female warriors who were stalkers, three male warriors, and one male courier, whom they were to nourish, enhance, and lead to freedom. Okay, so you have four women and four men. And the men are three male warriors and a courier. And this is the constitution of the sorcerer's party. Next comes the famous and now legendary description of the four female warriors and their characteristics. The first is of the East. She is called Order. She is optimistic, light-hearted, smooth, persistent, like a steady breeze. It so happens that there is, in my physical reality and in the company that I keep, which is very, very sparse company, I can assure you of that, the company that I keep in my so-called ordinary reality, a woman who fits this description. So there is an easterly woman. The second is the woman of the North. She is called Strength. She is resourceful, blunt, direct, tenacious like a hard wind. That would be Pachamama Medicine Woman, who came into my personal reality on the 21st of May, 2013. That woman, who by Castaneda's profiling is a member of the Sorcerer's Party, has shown up. The third is the West. She is called Feeling. She is introspective, remorseful, cunning, sly, like a cold wind. That is the first woman that showed up in my personal reality, the Westerly woman, whom you may know by the name of Kundry. Finally, the fourth is the South. She is called Growth. She is nurturing, loud, shy, warm, like a hot wind. This woman showed up in my personal reality in a shock event that I am still trying to understand during my travels in northern France at the beginning of this month. So how does this happen, that women who meet these characteristics have appeared? Castaneda goes on further to describe various features of these women. For instance, he says that the northerly woman has an overall radiation. She exudes a reddish glow, almost like heat. Well, I can attest to that. The northern woman is extremely radiant. He goes on to say that the westerly woman has a tenacious film enveloping her, a film that makes her appear darker than the others. You might recall that in the following chapter to the Rule of the Nahual, called the Nahual's Party of Warriors, Castaneda has a rather unsettling encounter with a couple of westerly women who are named Zoila and Zuleika. And this is the way that he characterizes these women. First of all, he says, Don Juan was taking me to go to meet a male warrior who was the man behind the scenes. So the man behind the scenes is another profile of someone in the warrior's party, namely Silvio Manuel. Now, I don't know exactly where I fit in the warrior's party, but it could be argued that I fit the profile of the man behind the scenes. In any case, when Don Juan took Carlos to meet Silvio Manuel, he said, Don Juan admonished me to exercise the utmost caution and patience. Not only were the two women, in the company of the man behind the scenes, raving mad, but they and the man were the most powerful warriors he had ever known. They were, in his opinion, the ultimate authorities of the second attention. Don Juan did not elaborate any further. One day, as though on the spur of the moment, he suddenly decided that it was time to start our trip to meet the westerly women. Then begins this hilarious adventure where Carlos meets these two women. He describes one of them in this way. The woman looked as if she had just gotten out of bed. She was a mess. Our knocking on the door had probably awakened her, and she must have put on a dress from her basket of dirty clothes. She was barefoot. Her hair was graying and terribly unkempt. She had red, beady eyes. She was rather a homely woman, but somehow very impressive. Rather tall, about 5'8", dark and muscular. Her bare arms were knotted with hard muscles. I noticed that she had beautifully shaped calves. Okay, so this characteristic of a westerly woman, you know, fits very closely to the westerly woman of my acquaintance, who was the first one to show up in the sorcerer's party here in Andalusia. No, she wasn't. Actually, the easterly woman showed up first. But the westerly woman moved in and became a permanent member of the party in May of 2011. And this westerly woman, a.k.a. Kundry, is currently my apprentice and accompanies me, as you know, on some of my telestic adventures with psychoactive plants. The westerly woman is a terrifying and turbulent character, a woman whose emotional turbulence is disturbing and off-putting to many people. Westerly woman can appear to be hysterical and can, in fact, burst into hysterical behavior in a minute, in a second, and 2 minutes and 11 seconds later, burst out of it. It must be said that the raw emotional turbulence, indeed, the emotional instability of the westerly woman, is extremely attractive to a certain type of male sorcerer along the lines of Silvio Manuel. Although it can be, and often is, disturbing, off-putting, and even repulsive to other people who witness it. The raw turbulence of emotion of the westerly woman is actually a tool, an asset, to her male counterpart in sorcery. And I have to say, there was a remarkable incident that happened here in the summer, in June. Three visitors came who might be considered also to be prospective sorcerers, two men and a woman. One of the men might be considered to fit the role of a courier, according to Don Juan's model of the sorcerer's party. This courier is an individual that I actually met here in Spain when I first came here in May of 2002. So you could say that the male members of the warrior party already showed up more than 10 years ago. One of the male members. Anyway, the courier came. I'll call him the courier, provisionally speaking. Courier came to visit me in June with a couple of people that I hadn't met. And one of those individuals, again, perhaps a prospective male warrior fitting somewhere in these profiles, made the observation about Kundry. A brilliant observation and a truthful observation. Whereas other people who have seen yours truly, the Nahual, with Kundry, have wondered, what in the hell is he doing with her? Having been put off by the rather terrifying aspect of the westerly woman. I use that to test people, by the way. But this individual was sober enough to make the comment, oh, I can see, she's crazy. And that summed it all up. It is that, quote, craziness of the westerly woman that attracts the male sorcerer, and that is, at the same time, the essence of her power and beauty as a sorcerer. So it's rather remarkable that I can speak of the particular details and traits of people that I know in my reality now, in my realm of human contacts, in a way that conforms so closely to these profiles that were written down by Carlos Castaneda over 20 years ago. I mean, how can this be? Well, it's because Castaneda's work is an immense product of human imagination that prefigures planetary tantra. And now that I am living and breathing planetary tantra every day of my life, it's not surprising that the elements of Castaneda's world are being pulled into the mix, you see. It's a big, big alchemical stew. I find it wonderful and entertaining to observe these similarities. I'm delighted that suddenly, within a period of time from the 21st of May, when the northerly woman appeared, until now, that I have the four types of women in direct personal proximity to myself. I find it delightful to observe this. And yet, there is no obligation for me to follow this model or to continue to try to conform in any way to the rules and guidelines of the Sorcerer's Party as Castaneda pronounced them. So, what is the point of even bringing this up? I'm bringing it up because I noticed it happening. And I suspect that something parallel may be happening in your lives as well. It may only apply to those of you who have been deeply immersed in Castaneda over the years, and it may apply in a more general sense, I don't know. I take it as a sign that the Kalika War Party is farming, and as it does, it shows in certain aspects and profiles a resemblance to the warrior party that Castaneda constructed. So there you have it. After all is said and done, one thing is brilliantly certain and brilliantly clear. The Kalika War Party is now forming spontaneously. You could say that the energy of correction itself is driving the formation of the Kalika War Party. While we may meet and recognize each other in a playful manner through the profiles and predilections that Castaneda described, those who come into the Kalika War Party are assuming a configuration that is only of here and now in the future, and that has nothing to do with the adventures in sorcery that you can read in his books, okay? As I've said, the Kalika War Party is a way of defining behaviors and strategies to be undertaken in Sophia's correction. By May of 2014, it may be possible to define the functions and strategies of all 16 components in the Kalika War Party. There are 16 V-shaped components. And so the Kalika War Party is the equivalent to the Sorcerer's Party in the Eagle's Gift, but it is current and ongoing and going forward. And it is a construction of human imagination in which you participate with me right now. It is a construct of imagination that describes strategies to be undertaken in the months and years to come. And these strategies, I can assure you, are real existential strategies. There is nothing abstract about them. They include the killing strike, and they include other powerful strategies for bringing down the society that is already falling apart, bringing down the way of life of Anthropos 10 that is no longer sustainable. Now you might ask, you know, why bring it down if it's already coming down? Well, the purpose of bringing it down is to make sure it stays down and, as far as possible, to speed its demise and to speed the conclusion, to speed to its conclusion, the way of life of Anthropos 10, thereby clearing the way for the emergence of Anthropos 11 and for the emergence of all the new behaviors that would arise from that transspeciated entity. So, having made all that clear as I can right now, folks, let's look at the one paramount factor that distinguishes the Calico War Party of today from Castaneda's band of sorcerers. That factor is a rule. Just as his projects in sorcery were defined by the rule of the Nahual, the projects you and I are undertaking today are defined by the rule of the Calicos. Now be clear on what the word Calico means. It's a derivation of the word Kali, obviously. K-A-L-I-K-A, Kalika, means, in fact, simply, a worshipper or devotee of Kali. Not in this traditional sense of Hindu religion or Kali worship in India. Forget that. That is a complete loss and a complete write-off. And I have nothing in common with that in my practice, and I completely disown Planetary Tantra, the GNA, and the Calico War Party from any association whatsoever with that disgusting Hindu tradition of Kali worship, which is nothing but obsequious pleading and enslavement to a traditional idea of a salvific mother figure. Fuck that. This is nothing like what's happening in the GNE. So you are a Kalika if you choose to be, if you elect to be. You can be in Planetary Tantra and in the GNE without being a Kalika. You can just be a Gayan Tantrika. That is to say, you can be a student of Planetary Tantra and you can follow the nav briefings of the GNE. So what makes you a Kalika? Well, quite simply, by knowing and accepting the rule of the Kalikas. But what is this rule? It is also called the bridge. Why is it called the bridge? Because it forms the bridge. It is a vow of sorts. And this vow forms the bridge between Planetary Tantra and Kala Tantra. Now, Planetary Tantra is, first of all, a general access method or practice of interactive magic with the Earth. And Kala Tantra is simply the extension of that practice into more particular and intricate methods and techniques involving specifically sexuality. And the use of sexual erotic forces for the purposes of magic and for conducting acts of sorcery, including three kinds of spells: the love spell, the killing spell, and passage of command. So it's easy to be in Planetary Tantra. You just do the Gayan Tantric vow. You pronounce the secret Dakini name of the Wisdom Goddess. And you follow the teachings and teach yourself and discuss it with others of like mind. And that may be all there is to it. Perhaps that's enough for you. And perhaps you'd like to keep it right there. But if you want to pass toward Kala Tantra and enter this 16-part array of the warrior party, then you take the vow of the Kalikas, which is to say, you learn the rule from the Nahual. So what I'm doing right now, in September of 2013, is transmitting to you the rule of the Kalikas in the way that Castaneda described the transmission of that rule by Don Juan to the Sorcerer's Party of that time, some 20 or 25 years ago. How do I transmit to you the rule of the Kalikas? I simply state the rule, but I do so with this qualification. I ask you to memorize the rule and not write it down. There's no harm in writing it down, but it's better if you memorize it so that you can repeat it verbatim. That is to say, repeat the rule exactly as I say it, and observe the rule in the precise language that I state it. And this is the rule of the Kalikas. You hold to your highest desire and surrender its attainment, not precluding that the attainment will be rendered to you by the power of the Shakti cluster. Memorize that rule so that you can say it exactly as I did, the identical words, and to a certain extent, the same phrasing or cadence. Here it comes again. Listen closely. You hold to your highest desire and surrender its attainment, not precluding that the attainment will be rendered to you by the power of the Shakti cluster. That is to say, by the power of the Gayandakinis, including both the 10 Mahavidyas and the 6 Diamond Sky Dakinis, including Vivi herself. Now, do I need to make any commentary on this rule? Yes, I have a little something to offer. I'd like to remind you that practice in Planetary Tantra is a virtuoso affair. The paradox of this practice is that it comes out of your own nature. It comes naturally and spontaneously to you, and yet at the same time, you undertake it at the highest level of rigor. This practice is extremely rigorous. Now consider the first part of the rule of the Kalikas. You hold to your highest desire, but surrender its attainment. That command, that instruction, is extremely rigorous. Believe me, I practice it, and I know from what I speak, and I know also from the testimony of a few others who practice that. First of all, even knowing what your highest desire is a magnificent achievement. Most human animals will go through their lives never knowing what they really desire, far less what is that which they desire above all else. That, by the way, the highest desire, is not always the same through your life. It is rather like, it presents itself rather like variations on some ultimate desire that you cannot finally and ultimately name, but you name the stages that you undergo on the way to that ultimate desire. So your highest desire can change at different moments in your life. Knowing what your highest desire is a rigorous practice. Then consider the second phrase, but surrender its attainment. Now this is something that really throws people. It can really throw people, and if it throws you, it's going to throw you right out of Planetary Tantra. If you don't get this, it will throw you out. You see, there is actually a teacher of Tantra. He's a popular cult leader. His name is Daniel Odier, O-D-I-E-R. He's French, and curiously, he was born in 1945, so he is of the same year as the Nawal. He is of the first year of the first of the 9 generations of Kali. And Daniel Odier teaches a kind of salon tantra for the bourgeois in which he proposes that you work with the power of your desire, but you surrender its object. Well, I have to ask you, what is desire without an object? According to Daniel Odier, desire without an object is the secret to the Tantra that he preaches, which is nothing more than sublimation of desire for the bourgeoisie, when you really look at it closely. It is absolutely absurd and ridiculous to posit desire without an object, because if desire does not have an object, it has no meaning, it has no reason to be desire. Now, the rigorous practice of Kalika Tantra, Kala Tantra, is to hold to your highest desire, but surrender its attainment. But you don't ultimately surrender its attainment, otherwise you would be engaged in an exercise of total frustration and exasperation, wouldn't you? So let's say that my highest desire is to own a beautiful catamaran. And your highest desire can be material, by the way. It can be anything you like. It can be sexual or material. It can be for a person or a thing. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I encourage it. Anyway, suppose my highest desire is for a magnificent catamaran. And I just want to park this catamaran somewhere in the Caribbean islands and live off it and have parties. That's my highest desire. Nothing wrong with that. Good thing to do in Kali Yuga. If I hold to that highest desire, it means I want that catamaran more than anything else in the world. But when I surrender its attainment, it means that I accept to live without attaining the desire. But at the same time that I accept to live without attaining the desire, I do not preclude that the attainment would be rendered to me through the power of the supernatural. The subtlety of that proposition is immense and extremely demanding. And I have to tell you that to practice the rule of the Kalika is not easy, even though it is, in a way, extremely easy. It is a practice that draws upon the natural inclination of your desires, but carries the act of desiring, you might say, to the level of a high art. It carries the act of desiring to a virtuoso level, where human desire merges and melds with the force of the supernatural. Because love and the supernatural operate on the same frequencies. The rule of the Kalikas is called the bridge because it is the bridge between being in planetary tantra, where you are not necessarily concerned with attaining your highest desire, and being in Kala Tantra, where you do indeed attain it. And over the last couple of weeks, I've been having a great time and laughing a lot and enjoying the repetition of a mantra that comes to mind, a mantra that came to my mind earlier this month. It's too good to be true. This is the mantra. It's too good to be true, but it is true. It's too good to be true, but it is true. I keep repeating this mantra. Why do I repeat this mantra? Because I am a Kalika who follows the rule. And I know what happens when the attainment of my highest desire, which I have surrendered, is rendered unto me. It's too good to be true, but it is true. Every single person who follows the rule of the Kalika will have the identical experience I am describing here. There is a coiled power. There is a mainspring of spectacular magic in that rule. You create a tension within the field of your own desire. You create a supernatural state of tension in your own desire when you hold passionately to it, but surrender the attainment of it, not precluding that that attainment is rendered unto you from the realm of the supernatural. The implication to learn in the rule of the Kalika is that what you cannot render unto yourself by control or by wishing for it, according to the ridiculous formula of New Age spirituality, the secret, what you cannot attain by yourself, arising from the natural craving of your own desire, is attainable in the supernatural connection and in the transpersonal connection to the power of the earth itself and the infernal Dakini forces streaming from the earth straight into your mind and into your heart and into your body and into every cell of your body at every single moment that you live. And in fact, the rule of the Kalikas predisposes you to receive that impouring of the divine from the planetary animal mother herself. And bear in mind that kama, desire, kama is her divine emanation to you. And when she reaches you with her love, when the Aeon Sophia reaches you with her love, she reaches you first with her desire and then her love. She reaches you through desire. In your own highest desire, she reaches you if you are receptive to be reached in that way. And in doing so, she induces in you, through desire, the precursor to the reception of her love, which is an obliterating beauty and generosity beyond anything you can conceive or imagine. So the rule of the Kalika has a number of vital functions in Gayan Tantra. It bridges between planetary Tantra and Kala Tantra. It links you to the dynamics of the Shakti cluster, particularly in the desideristic aspect of those goddesses and Dakinis. That is to say, the power they have to fulfill all of your wishes, all of your desires, personal and material, as well as transpersonal. And thirdly, and finally, the rule of the Kalikas prepares you to receive the love of the Aeon Sophia. You know, it's natural for everyone to wonder, well, you know, does she love us? Does she love me individually? It's natural to live with that question, ponder that question. Once you encounter planetary Tantra, that question comes up vividly. It's a haunting question. And then you may start to look at your life and look at the conditions of your life and think, well, I don't see the evidence or proof in my life that she does because I don't have the conditions that I would like. Conditions I require in order to live according to my love for her. So why doesn't she show me her love for me so that I can live out my love for her? And you go into a number of spirals and a number of loops and a number of emotional runarounds in your own mind in that manner. But what I want to tell you right now is something that you have not perhaps considered. You can ask yourself, if the Aeon Sophia loves you, but you might do better to ask yourself, are you prepared to experience what happens when you realize that she does and how she does? And I can tell you that you're not prepared unless it comes first through desire. The power of her love for you, as a magical child in her dreaming, is inconceivable unless it comes to you first through your desire, and then it comes as pure love, which is obliterating beauty and generosity. If you want the conditions in your life that allow you to live in her love, in the two-way proposition, you loving the planetary animal mother and she loving you, if you want those conditions, then follow the rule of the Kalikas. Trust your desire, honor your desire, hold to your highest desire, and surrender its attainment, not precluding that the attainment will be rendered to you by the power of the Shakti cluster. That is a rigorous practice. Reflect on it carefully. Discuss it among yourselves. Go over it over and over again. Hone your comprehension of that rule to a razor edge. Hone it like the blade of a samurai sword. And I assure you that in the practice of that rule, every conceivable personal, emotional, material, financial, and sexual pleasure and desire that you could ever wish for can be yours. And when it comes, you will repeat the same mantra that everyone else repeats. It's too good to be true, but it is true. It is true. This is the mantra that I repeat now in my life, and I impart it to you so that it may resonate in every day and in every way through every aspect of your life. Until that moment when you can say that the truth of the rule of the Kalikas is your own truth, your supreme truth, and that is the truth by which you live in her magic.